Welcome to the Conversation Lab. I'm Don Schaefer. If democracy begins in conversation, then we need to nurture a culture where ordinary people like us routinely talk about those things that help us understand each other, whether it's about climate, race, religion, gender, or politics. When we're trying to make sense of our city and the world we live in, every question comes with a set of assumptions about the nature of ourselves and our place in a larger world. The Conversation Lab provides a safe place to talk about some of those things. This program is produced by CFRO-FM in Vancouver. It's available on air and online on various platforms, and we appreciate the help of Vancouver's community groups. This is the Conversation Lab. We have Catherine Hayhoe on the phone. If you don't know who Catherine Hayhoe is, she is somebody I would define as a rock star professor. Catherine is an atmospheric scientist and associate professor of political science at Texas Tech. She's the director of the Climate Science Center there, and together with her husband, Andrew Farley, I think they've written at least 8 books. I think it started with The Naked Gospel, and most recently, A Climate Change, Global Warming Facts for Faith-Based Decisions. And you may have seen her PBS series. It's called Global Weirding, Climate, Politics, and Religion. The last time we talked, I gave you up as Canadian and that you were born in Ontario.
Yes, that's correct.
And since we've talked, you've endured a number of IPCC reports and extreme weather, hurricanes, more criticism, and a lot more accolades for your work. I'm curious, when you look back over the last year and a half, you know, what's it been like for you?
Well, things have definitely ratcheted up a few notches in the last year and a half. I would say that levels of concern now across Canada as well as the U.S. are higher than they've been in over a decade of polling, and that's because we're starting to recognize that climate change is no longer a distant issue. We can point to specific ways that climate change is exacerbating or amplifying natural weather extremes in the places where we live. But at the same time, because we're getting closer to actually taking action on this issue, the opposition is ramping up too. And this is absolutely true in Canada as well as south of the border. There is a lot of very vocal and very vehement opposition to the idea that we have to cut our carbon emissions, not to save the planet, but to save ourselves.
Do you find that the discussion has changed a bit? I don't even know what to call it.
Well, there's certainly a lot of science denial, even in, like I said, in Canada. And I hear about it every day on social media. But you're right. There's a lot more people saying now, well, sure, it's real, but I don't want to do this. I don't want to put a price on carbon. Or down south, I don't want to support the Green New Deal, or I don't want to support a carbon tax. There's currently a bill before Congress in the United States to put a price on carbon federally as well. So people are really, as you said, kind of coming out from behind the smoke screen of, I don't think the science is real, to voice what's closer to their real concerns, which is, I don't want to fix it.
And how do you deal with that? I mean, you do a lot of public speaking, and you talk to the science, and you also talk to the compassionate human interest side of that discussion. How do you bridge the two?
Well, what I say is, from the perspective of science, it doesn't matter how we cut the carbon. You can cut it with a price on carbon, you can cut it with cap and trade, you can cut it with a, you know, total dictatorship or with voluntary efforts. The planet doesn't care how we cut the carbon, but we have to do it. So when people say, well, I don't want a price on carbon, for example, or in the States, I don't support the Green New Deal, my response is, that's absolutely your prerogative, because policy and politics are a matter of opinion. But what is your solution then to cut carbon as quickly as we need to avoid not only serious but even potentially dangerous impacts for us here at home as well as around the world?
What are the most important things you've worked on in the last year?
Well, I served as a lead author for the U.S. National Climate Assessment, which is currently still the most up-to-date document on the state of the science around the world, as well as looking in more detail about what climate change means to each economic sector and each region of the U.S. I also got to participate in the Nobel Peace Prize Forum discussing not just climate science, but climate solutions, which was really, I think, a positive step in the right direction. And, of course, we've continued with our Global Weirding series. That's a short series that we have on PBS on YouTube. And we made a Canada episode, too. And then most recently, just this very month, April and May, I was the guest editor for Châtelet magazine. So if you can pick up the issue of April and May, there's a lot of really good articles about what we can do personally and why climate change matters to us.
Do you have time to teach?
Yes, I do. I have a full-time job, which includes teaching. And I love what I do because my students come from across the university. I have students from humanities, social sciences, engineering, physical sciences, and more. And the class I taught this semester was all about how to incorporate what we know about climate and weather risks into planning. If we are going to work in public administration, if we are going to be an engineer or a planner, if we're going to work in any type of business or industry, what is it that we already know about how climate change is supersizing the risks that we face that can help us build resilience to a changing climate?
Because of the notoriety that you get around the world, I've always called you one of those rock star professors. I got to imagine that one of your classes would be fun.
I definitely aim for that. I want the class to be memorable, and I want it to give people the information that they actually need to take forward. So we have a lot of discussion, and there's a lot of leeway in terms of the topics of the projects that students get to pick. And because of that, frankly, I enjoy it too, because I get to learn from them as well.
Have you noticed a difference in the class structure in terms of the kinds of questions that you get?
Yes, I would say that among students, even here in Texas, there is a lot higher levels of concern today than there was 10 years ago. Most people now are coming into my classes already aware that climate is changing, humans are responsible, the impacts are serious, and their questions all revolve around how do I have this conversation with people in my community, people I know, people I work with, and what can I personally do about this?
You were talking about conversations the last time we talked about the difficulty of building bridges to different communities. And you do it, I think, on purpose. You go to different congregations and talk about being an evangelist as well as a scientist in bridging those two worlds with a local community. How do you do that?
Well, my favorite type of invitation is the invitation where you can kind of tell that they're hoping that you'll say no when they invite you. And you also can tell that if you say no, that they're not going to invite anyone else. They're just going to sigh and shrug and say, well, we tried, and move on. So those are the types of invitations that I absolutely say yes to. And I just had one 2 weeks ago where I was at a very conservative Christian college where the person who invited me definitely wanted me to come speak. I always, you know, I wouldn't go if I wasn't invited. But even that person, that faculty member who invited me, experienced significant opposition from fellow faculty members and even administrators at that university saying, you know, why is this woman coming? She's just coming to tell us that the only solution to climate change is abortion, and that's not what we stand for. So when I heard that, I thought, well, this is exactly where I want to be and exactly what I want to talk about, because fossil fuel extraction, of course, affects the health and well-being of the unborn. It affects maternal health. It has enormous impacts through combustion on our health as children and adults. And all told, pollution is responsible for nearly 9 million deaths around the world. So if we're going to be pro-life, we have to be pro-life all the way to the end of our lives. And that means that we are the very people that care passionately about issues of pollution associated with fossil fuel.
I'm curious what the reaction is like in the congregation when you stand before them as a Christian and as a scientist.
Well, a lot of my talks are not given specifically to congregations. I give a few what you'd call sermons a year, but most of them are more kind of parachurch organizations or Christian colleges or universities. But when I'm able to speak in person, the result is pretty uniformly positive. In fact, the talk that I just gave, one of the administrators who had vehemently opposed me coming, he actually attended the talk, which I really appreciate because often these people will send emails and then they won't even attend the talk. And it's like, well, what's the point of that? But he did. And afterwards, he said that he enjoyed it. So in person, the response is usually quite positive. There's one or two people who are dismissive, people who, you know, even if an angel from God appeared before them with tablets of stone saying global warming is real and foot-high letters of flame, they wouldn't change their minds. But aside from those people, it's usually a very good response. But the challenge is we don't see the same type of response online. So much of our communication is done online these days, and I'm very active on Twitter and Facebook and even Instagram now. And I see my role there is very different because when somebody doesn't agree with you online, it is extremely rare for them to be willing to even click on a link that you give them. The number one question I get, or not question really, but objection I get is, don't you know it's been warmer before? And of course, my snarky answer to that would be, well, how do you know it's been warmer before? It's because of climate scientists who study paleoclimate, that's why. But I bite back the snarky answer, and I usually say, you know, that's a great question. Here's one of our global weirding episodes that specifically addresses this question. And unfortunately, and I've actually experimented with this, more than 9 times out of 10, the person who's objecting to me on social media where they can't look at me eye to eye, they are incapable of clicking on the link. They are 100% unwilling to even click on a link that answers an objection they have because, I'm afraid to say, I think fear is really at the root of it. They're really afraid of anything that they think would tell them that who they are is not a good person. And so that's what I think is important to emphasize when we talk about climate change, is that most of us already have the values we need to care. We really do. And who we are is exactly the right person to care. But we just haven't connected the dots between what our values are and why that matters to a changing climate.
So how do we do that? How do we connect the dots? How do we get beyond the fear?
Well, I forgot to mention I did a TED Talk this year, too. That just came out in December, and my TED Talk was exactly about that. How do we talk about climate change? So what I said in a nutshell is we have to start where people are at. We have to start with the values that people already have. And if we don't know what matters to a person or a group of people, then the first thing we need to do is actually listen to them and have a conversation with them and learn that first before we open our mouths. So how does that work? Well, for example, if I'm talking to a group of farmers or producers, I often start by talking about natural variability. I show them some of the advanced forecasts that we have for seasonal forecasts. So in the winter, you can actually get an idea of what the summer is going to be like in terms of hotter, drier, wetter, colder, and they really appreciate that. And then I talk about long-term trends that they've already observed, and I ask them for their stories about, well, how did you cope with the drought of 2011, or what did you do when it flooded in 2013? And then from there, from their concerns, we can kind of walk together to, well, do you know that these things are actually getting more frequent? What are you going to do? How are we going to cope with this? If I'm talking to people in the oil and gas industry, which I do, the first time I was invited to speak to an oil and gas company, I realized, how am I going to effectively have a conversation if I can't start with something that we agree on? So I thought about it for quite a while, and then I realized, and this may seem kind of obvious, but it took me a while to realize, you know, I'm actually very grateful for fossil fuels. I do not want to go back and live in the 1600s or 1700s. Fossil fuels freed women from a life of unending drudgery. They eventually allowed us to eliminate child labor. They contributed to ending slavery. They brought us, you know, electricity and transportation and all the conveniences of modern life. This has all been powered by fossil fuels. And the people who did this work worked very hard. It is not an easy industry to work in to make sure that people have the energy they needed. And when you look at poor countries today, many of those countries are poor because they didn't have ample access to affordable fossil fuels. So starting there, we can actually take the conversation towards energy and how energy is so important for all of us, but then we can say, but where we get our energy from is changing. Just like we used to use horses and buggies, and now we use cars. Just like we used to use letters and telegraphs or telegrams, and now we use, you know, the internet and cell phones, our energy is changing too. How can we make sure people still have the energy they need in the future at the same time that we are undergoing a massive transition off fossil fuels? So we can start these conversations, you know, with skiing, with birding, with sailing, with the well-being of the city that we live in, what's happening to Vancouver and Surrey and the concerns about sea level rise and flooding. We can start our conversation with something people agree on, and then we can connect the dots, really focusing more on sharing from the heart than from the head and emphasizing what we agree on more than what we disagree on.
When you connect the head and the heart, do you have any people that you follow, that you read, that you would recommend?
I do. One of the people I've learned the most from is a man called George Marshall, who runs an organization called Climate Outreach. They are based in the UK, but they've been doing workshops actually across Canada, so some people might be familiar with his name. He wrote a book called Don't Even Think About It, How Our Brains Are Wired to Ignore Climate Change. And I just thought that was fascinating. And he has great insights into how we have all these facts and data and science going back to the 1850s, but we haven't connected that information with what really matters to us. And that's where the true disconnect is.
I'm curious about that comment because the United Nations has put out a number of reports. The most recent report suggested that we have 12 years to limit climate change before we reach catastrophic proportions. Can you talk about that?
I can. So to clarify, what the IPCC's 1.5-degree report actually said is, if we want to reach 1.5 degrees specifically, we can only produce a certain amount of carbon. So that's what the science tells us. Here's how much carbon we can produce if we want to stay below 1.5 degrees, if we want to stay below 2 degrees, if we want to stay below 3 degrees. And then the report went one step further and it said, here is one pathway by which we could reduce our emissions to reach that target. And that is really not a question of physical science, it's a question of economics and technology. So given where we are, given where we want to be, we can't flip the switch today and turn everything off because that would actually create worse suffering. But if we do nothing, that will create worse suffering. So where is kind of the middle balance between weaning ourselves off fossil fuels as soon as possible while still keeping the lights on? So that was one scenario that they provided in the report, if we can meet 1.5 degrees. But what the science really tells us is this. For every half degree, you know, every gigaton of carbon we produce, every half degree that we warm, there are additional impacts. So for some people in some places, 1.5 degrees might be manageable. For some people, 1 degree is already dangerous. If you live on a low-lying island in the South Pacific, if you live in the Maldives, if you live up in the Arctic where permafrost is crumbling and thawing under your feet. For other people, 2 degrees might be where we reach a dangerous level of change. Or for some systems, some places, sometimes even 2.5 or 3. So what's dangerous is really a value judgment. The science can tell us if we want to stay below 1.5 or 2 degrees, here's the carbon we can produce. But it's up to us to decide what's dangerous. And so the idea that we have 12 years or 19 or 11 years now that we've gone from 2018 to 2019, the idea that we only have 11 years left to fix this problem, I think, is it shows us how urgent the problem is, but it also runs the risk of us feeling like, well, there's no way we can do it in that time, so let's just throw up our hands and give up. And the reality is everything we do matters. The quicker we wean ourselves off carbon and replace fossil fuels with clean energy sources, the better off we'll be. But every step we take in that direction has an impact.
You've been quoted over the years of saying we're like frogs in boiling water. Do you still feel like that?
Yeah, but I feel like our frogs are starting to notice that there's a few bubbles in the water.
Okay.
So in public polling in the U.S., they've been polling people a couple times a year now for over a decade. And this January, they found the biggest jumps in levels of concern in the United States that they have ever seen. They have found that over among registered Democrat voters, so, you know, on the liberal side in the U.S., the biggest issue for registered Democratic voters in the U.S. is now climate change, which it certainly wasn't 4 years ago, I can tell you that. And even for Republicans, almost 60% of Republicans support climate action, which is truly remarkable. So the tide is turning, and we see this too in Canada with a price on carbon. But at the same time, the closer we get to meaningful action, and don't get me wrong, the planet doesn't care how we cut the carbon, but a carbon price certainly will help. The closer we get to meaningful action, like putting a price on carbon, unfortunately, the stronger the resistance. And we are absolutely seeing this in provincial elections across Canada, as well as likely in our upcoming federal election as well.
I'm not quite sure where to go with that. It's, is it hopeful or hopeless?
It has to be rational hope, I think, because if our reaction is fear, then fear is good at, you know, giving us enough adrenaline to outrun the bear or maybe just the person beside us. But fear is not going to help us fix this long-term, slow-moving problem. To fix it, we need hope. But at the same time, the hope has to be rational. It has to be informed by how bad the situation really is and how urgent our action is. So what I do when I talk to people is And this is what I did actually in Chatelaine, this for the April May issue. I wrote an essay specifically about how climate change is affecting us in Canada. And there's a couple of other really good essays by a medical doctor, by a woman whose family was affected by the smokes in the Fort McMurray wildfires. There's a bunch of articles in Chatelaine that talk about how we personally are affected by a changing climate. But then we also have to talk about what a better future looks like, because on the one hand, we have all these apocalyptic visions of what's going to happen if, you know, we don't meet a 1.5-degree target by 2030. But then on the other hand, we have these apocalyptic visions of, oh, well, Canada's only a tiny part of global emissions, and we're going to ruin our economy and destroy our resources, you know, just for nothing. So we're presented with kind of dueling or opposing apocalyptic visions of the future, and what we really need is a hopeful vision. What would it look like if we were able to transition our economy to clean energy, to become a global tech leader, as we certainly have the potential and the brain power to do? What would happen if we're able to help poor countries who don't currently have access to coal or gas or oil, but they certainly have a lot of wind and a lot of sun? What would that world look like where we clean up our air and our water to the point where 9 million people don't die from pollution anymore? And we're able to stabilize volatile areas of the world so that when there's civil conflict, when there's political conflict, climate change isn't acting as a threat multiplier, as the U.S. Department of Defense calls it. You know, making drought stronger and sea level rise, flooding areas, and creating enormous amounts of refugees, which then need a place to go, and we are one of the countries that tends to welcome refugees. We need to paint the picture of what the better world looks like, and that's what we really need to be heading towards.
What do you think about the demonstrations that are occurring in Europe, or London specifically, and some of the school strikes? How does that figure into this conversation?
It absolutely does figure in, because it is people expressing themselves, people expressing their concern, their fear, their increasingly panic that governments are not taking this seriously fast enough. And I have to say, I particularly admire the school children who are doing this, who are doing the school strikes in North America and around the world, because it is their future that's at risk. You know, we are already experiencing the impacts of climate change today. Over our lives, we are going to see worse things happen, especially if we don't take action soon. But they're the ones who ultimately will inherit what we have done. And so the fact that they are standing up and saying, it is our future, it is our planet, we need action now, I admire that tremendously.
I'm curious about your comments about how climate change affects poorer countries and the marginalized.
So what we see is, even today, for example, when a hurricane hits a Caribbean island, for example, Haiti, or even Puerto Rico, which is part of the United States, and then the same hurricane hits Florida or the Carolinas, you see devastation in both places. You see loss of property, even loss of life. But the magnitude of the devastation in places that are already suffering from a cholera epidemic exacerbated by the destruction of the facilities to process water in Haiti, you don't see anything like that when the same hurricane hits the U.S. Building codes in places, the electric grid, power supply, food supply and resources, even energy are so much more limited in places. And when they're knocked out by a natural disaster that is increasingly supersized by a changing climate, they are already starting with so much less that the impacts are so much greater. So the reason why I care about climate change personally, not as a scientist but as a human, is because it is a threat multiplier. It takes issues like hunger and poverty and disease and lack of access to clean water that kills millions of people around the world every year, and most of them under the age of 5. It takes even refugee crises, and it exacerbates them. We already have these challenges that we're trying to fix. People are suffering today already, and climate change is like the final straw on the camel's back in many of those situations. We will not be able to fix them if we leave climate change out of the picture.
You're the CEO of Atmos Research. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So my research specifically looks at developing high-resolution climate projections that people can use for planning at the local to regional scale. But, you know, as a scientist, once you've developed it and once you've published it and once you've made your methods and your data public, you can't keep on doing the same thing. You're done. You have to move on to something new. But what we found is there's a lot of organizations, like especially cities and water districts, that want to use the information that we generate in their planning. And so we say, well, you know, here's the data that we generated. And they're like, well, NetCDF file, what's that? how do I put that into? And so there's a lot of translation work to be done between the work that we produce academically and actually being able to plug that into the water yield models that a district might use to plan for its water future, or looking at a city, looking at their infrastructure and their public health and their transportation system and how it's affected by warmer temperatures and more frequent rainfall. So I created the consulting company, particularly, to work with organizations who don't want new science done, but who are challenged in taking what's already out there and really translating it into information that they can use. Because today we've already reached the point where we have to be accounting for climate change. It's kind of like as if you're driving down a road and, you know, for the last few hundred years, you know, really for the course of human civilization on this planet, the climate has been remarkably stable. There's been really tiny little fluctuations, like the Little Ice Age and the medieval warm period, which were actually local. They weren't global. But overall, climate has been very stable. And so we typically plan our infrastructure design, our energy needs, our water, almost every aspect of society, including the clothes we have in our closet, is based off looking to the past, what it's been like in the place where we live 10, 20, 30, 50, 100 years ago, and then using that as a guide to the future. But that's like driving down the road looking in the rearview mirror. It works great if the road is straight. Looking in the rearview mirror will keep you on the road if the road is straight. I don't recommend it, but it will work. I've tried it here in Texas, and it works. There's very straight roads here. But if there is a curve in the road, and there is the occasional curve, even in Texas, if there is a curve in the road and we are looking backwards, we are going to end up in a place that we did not intend to be, let's just say. And that's the situation we face now with transportation infrastructure, with our buildings, with our energy supply, with our water. So a lot of the work I actually do is with organizations that might kind of surprise people, like federal highways and, you know, municipal water and waste districts and people looking at invasive or endangered species, and even farming and production organizations who are looking at the future of what type of crops they would grow where and when and how.
I'm encouraged by that comment. I'm encouraged by the businesses and organizations and communities looking for your help to initiate change.
That is already happening. And Surrey and Vancouver, for example, are two really good examples of municipalities that are already doing their own resilience planning. But I think the best way to think of this is a quote by a man called John Holdren, who was President Obama's science advisor. He said, we have three choices. We can reduce our carbon emissions, we can adapt or prepare for a different climate, or we can suffer. And we are going to do some of each. The only question is how much, because the faster we reduce our carbon emissions, the less change we're going to have to adapt to and the less suffering there will be.
You're on a number of boards. Do you still chair the Earth Science Women's Network?
I do chair the advisory board for them, and I'm also involved in a lot of different organizations, from museums to educational outreach programs to faith-based organizations as well.
Can we talk about how we get more women into science?
Oh, I would love that. Because at the level where I'm at, I'm a professor in earth sciences. Depending on how you define our field, between 9 to 13% of us are women. That is an abysmally low number. And what research has shown is that when you have a greater diversity of voices in the room in terms of gender, culture, age, and other, that's where you get the greatest diversity of ideas and solutions, which is absolutely what we need when it comes to a changing climate. So that's why I serve the Earth Science Women's Network, which not only looks at bringing more women into studying earth science in industry, academia, nonprofit, government, and other, but it also looks at retention. Because what we found is that there's a lot of women coming in, but there's a lot of us who end up dropping out because we are in a system that is not really created for, you know, I have to leave at 3:30 to pick up my child from school, or, you know, I can't go to, a faculty meeting that starts at 7 p.m. because I have a family at home. Or it's just starting to get to the point now where you're allowed to delay your tenure clock or delay your grants when you have a baby and associated medical issues. So there's a lot of work to be done, and I do it, first of all, because I believe that women deserve the opportunities, the same opportunities as our male colleagues. But I also do it because I believe that we want as many and as diverse voices at the table, especially on such an important issue like a changing climate.
Two final questions. One, are you still knitting?
Oh, yes. Yes, I am.
And can you talk about the latest book?
Sure. So Ravelry is my favorite website. You know, there's more knitters than golfers in North America, if you can believe it.
I believe it.
Yes. And I love being able to produce something concrete because so much of what I do is speaking or writing or computer code or models. I love being able to actually see something physical in front of me. So I do a lot of writing. Like I mentioned, I guest edited and I wrote for the April and May issue of Chatelaine magazine. I also wrote an article for Oprah magazine in January. I'm revising the book that I wrote with my husband, Climate for Change, Global Warming Facts for Faith-Based Decisions, and I'm actually getting ready to possibly write a new book. I was just scoping it out, some ideas I have about a lot of the myths that we believe, because our Global Weirding episodes get into some of those myths, you know, how do we know it's not a natural cycle? I'm just one person, what can I do to fix it? And even our Canadian-y sounding myths, like, you know, Canada really doesn't have that many people. We don't produce that much, you know, carbon dioxide. Our forests suck it all up anyways, which actually is not true most years. There's nothing that we could do that matters. I think there's a lot of myths that we're still believing that some clear information, I think, would help to dispel.
Catherine, I know you're jammed for time. I really want to take this opportunity to thank you for spending some of your time with us. It's always a pleasure.
I appreciate you having me. Thank you so much. Let's do it again.
We've been talking with Catherine Hayhoe, one of the top scientists in the world on climate change. If you'd like to learn more about Catherine and her work, you can find her on social media and at CatherineHayhoe.com. This has been another episode of The Conversation Lab. The Conversation Lab is produced in Vancouver's downtown Eastside on the territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. Our thanks to them and the many not-for-profit organizations and community groups for their support of this radio program and podcast. If you enjoyed it, please don't forget to support your local community or campus radio station. Also, if you know of anyone or an organization with a story to share, please let them know about us. We can be found at cooperadio.org or theconversationlab.ca. The Conversation Lab is magically produced by Kimmett Sacon. Thanks, Kimmett. Thanks for joining us. I'm Don Schaefer.